You're 23. You're over the moon that you've landed the prestigious Watson Fellowship. Now, this means you can dedicate 14 months to digging into whatever fascinates you. I'm talking about Linnea Burnham, who, when her guidance counselor at Middlebury College in Vermont asked her what was the most important thing to her of all things, Linnea immediately said cheese. And that's how an adventure and a blog called Cheese Girl began. Linnea, welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So where did this obsession, I hope that's not an exaggeration, with cheese come from?
Well, my passion for cheese is really a passion for home that emerged from a passion in agriculture that I got from my grandfather who used to raise Holstein cows. I mean, some of my earliest memories are helping my grandfather take care of cows and feeding them hay and grain and so on. And then when I was 16, I became a Rotary student and I was put in Besançon, France, which is in eastern France where they make a lot of cheese. And that experience kind of opened my eyes up to the world of cheese. I came home a year later, started working for cheesemakers in Vermont, and then later on in college, I started drawing all the connections between cheese and so many greater issues that interest me, like the future of our agriculture.
Well, when you started traveling, though, 14 months on the road with that knapsack, you picked some interesting places. Mongolia, Brazil, South Africa. First of all, Mongolia. Why Mongolia?
Oh, sure. Well, Mongolia fascinated me because I really wanted to go to a place that hadn't been industrialized like the rest of the world. So much of cheesemaking history has been shaped by global markets or international pressures or new technologies. But Mongolia is really isolated, and I wanted to see what cheesemaking might have been like, you know, as close as I could come to seeing what cheesemaking might have been like 1,000 years ago. And I ended up living with a family of nomadic herders in a yurt somewhere in the countryside. And I still don't really know where I was because I don't speak Mongolian, but I was really lucky because I met a woman in the capital who spoke English, and she told me that if I wanted to stay with her cousin's cousins and make cheese, I could. And when you get an offer like that, you just don't say no. And so after that, I got in a car, ended up at this yurt, and was making cheese. And making cheese there meant using soured horse milk to coagulate the cow milk. It meant making cheese over a fire, milking by hand, of course. And I really found that cheese making in Mongolia is tied to survival in a way that it isn't in the rest of the world. First off, to make cheese in Mongolia, you have to use all the resources that you have. And they don't have access to modern technologies. They don't have access to industrial cultures or rennet or these cheesemaking supplies that you can generally order online in other countries. And the taste isn't as important in cheese over there. It's really about conserving the fat and the protein in milk so that you can transport it and move with it as you're migrating throughout the countryside.
It's interesting, the soured horse milk as a coagulant. But is there a horse milk cheese, actually?
Yes, there is. I think few people realize how much of a milk country Mongolia is. And they milk camels, and they milk horses, and they milk cows, sheep, goats, yaks, and they make cheese or some dairy product with all of these.
So what did the cheese taste like, the one you were making?
I have to say it's not my favorite cheese. It is...
That's
really
very
taste...
diplomatic of you.
You know, it's the only cheese I've ever had that I almost broke a tooth on.
It that is... hard?
Yeah. I guess I should explain briefly how it's made. Once you've coagulated the cheese with soured horse milk, they press it lightly overnight and then cut it into thin strips. They take these thin strips and they string them with like a needle and a thread, and they hang them to dry on the walls of their home, of their yurt. And the cheese dries out and becomes like a rock. And so you either eat it really slowly by sort of just sucking on it and trying to break it down in your mouth, and that takes a very long time, or you dip it in maybe a hot tea. But it's really unusual, and I think it tastes really animal. You can taste the yurt. You can taste the, you know, the yaks or the cows or the horses.
Tell me about Brazil.
Well, actually, Brazil, I flew from Brazil to Mongolia, and that was probably the longest flight of my life. but the reason I chose to go to Brazil was I wanted to see how cheesemaking traditions from Europe had been adapted to new places through colonization and through imperialism. And in Brazil, I'd heard about queijo da canastra, which is made in Minas Gerais, which is a region outside of Sao Paulo. And it's a region that's really all about cheesemaking. And over 300 years ago, when the first Portuguese colonists arrived, they came to this region and they were looking for gold and they were mining, but they started making cheese and they've been doing it continuously for the past 300 years. And the other piece that's really fascinating about Brazil is understanding Brazilian politics. And in the 1950s, Brazil created a legislation that outlawed the sale of all raw milk cheese outside of Minas Gerais, where it was produced. But because this cheese has always been raw milk and the farmers there don't have the means to adopt modern technologies or comply with the legislation, they can't legally sell their cheese. So you have this really interesting situation with over 30,000 families who make cheese and that's their primary income, but they can't legally sell it. So I went to Brazil to understand these issues better and also see how cheese making had been adapted to a tropical climate.
So is this sort of a black market product?
That's what they call it there. But it's also a product of love. One of my favorite things about Brazil was finding the combination of queijo and guava, and they call the two together Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, that's a lovely idea.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of lovely combinations, I'm thinking about the holidays, and I always think of cheese as being something celebratory. Did you see any examples of it used in that way?
Absolutely. In Norway, I went to a geitost festival. A geitost is a typical Norwegian cheese, and it originated from this tiny village that was isolated by road until 1988, and I ended up kayaking there to this festival. Another great festival is the Gloucester cheese rolling that happens in England every year. It's a race after a wheel of cheese actually down a very steep, steep slope. And then, of course, in Italy, every 2 years, there's a festival called Cheese, and the name kind of says it all. It's this tiny village that becomes inundated with cheese for 4 days, with cheesemakers from all over the world who pour in to showcase their cheese, and it's really a celebration of cultural diversity.
Linnea, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
Linnea Burnham is a Thomas J. Watson Fellow. Now, for more information about Linnea and her cheese blog, head to the website. And since it feels like fondue season, we've posted one of our favorite recipes, 007 Fondue. And you're going to find it all at that glorious place, splendidtable.org.